Intelligence officials say that air samples taken after North Korea's purported nuclear test this week now show no presence of radioactive particles. Earlier today, Japanese tests yielded the same findings. This revelation comes as U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Bolton announced late morning, East Coast time, that the U.N. Security Council has agreed on the text of a resolution to impose strict new sanctions on North Korea. The resolution had been stalled for most of the week, with Russia and China objecting to key components. A vote on the new version will be held tomorrow. Linda Fasulo covers the United Nations for NBC News. She joins us from New York. And Linda, we're hearing this is a gentler resolution. How so? Explain what's in it.
Well, it may be a gentler resolution, but it still is rather strong. It's a resolution that obviously aims to prevent the sale or transfer of weapons or weapons-related items that can be used by North Korea for its nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction programs. And what it does is it imposes a ban on countries dealing with North Korea in this respect, and also calls for the freeze of assets of North Korean persons and entities abroad that are involved in supporting its program.
We understand it calls for the six-nation talks to resume.
Exactly. It calls for the six-nation talks to resume, and it also demands that North Korea's nuclear programs and weapons programs be eliminated.
Does it have any teeth in it?
Well, interestingly, it does have some teeth, I think. The question is how those teeth will actually bite. You know, the devil is always in the details of implementing these resolutions. But the measure does call for a Security Council committee to be formed to sort of oversee how countries are implementing these sanctions. And it does allow for cargo going into and out of North Korea to be monitored and checked.
That's been a sticking point for China in particular.
Exactly. I mean, the language has been toned down. China has been concerned that that issue could be viewed as a provocative action by North Korea, and so wanted it to, be done cooperatively. I mean, there's language in the resolution that sort of tones it down so that it says this would be in accordance with international law and national authorities and would be cooperative, so you don't have a sense of a naval blockade of North Korea and a very sort of military presence.
Well, I was going to say, what about military action? We understand the resolution is going to be passed. It's going to be voted on, and the hope is it will be passed under Chapter 7, which is the most binding, serious chapter, and it could include military action. Is military action included in the resolution?
Absolutely not. In fact, what's very interesting, I think there's a lot of confusion about Chapter 7 and the authorization of the use of force. Chapter 7 basically makes it clear that a resolution is mandatory and legally binding on both the country like North Korea as well as the rest of the member states, because other member states also have a job to do. Mm-hmm. But the resolution does not naturally authorize the use of military force to implement the measure. And in fact, any resolution under Chapter 7 generally does not permit military enforcement unless there's a subsequent resolution that calls on nations to take all necessary means to implement it. So I think there's sometimes a little confusion about that. But that being said, China has been concerned and wanted it clearly stated that there is no threat of force in this resolution.
And just quickly, does the announcement today that neither Japan nor the U.S. found any nuclear particles after the alleged nuclear test this week, does that change anything about the sanctions?
I don't believe so. In fact, I mean, as we know, all week long it's been questionable about the size and extent of this test. But I think that the international community, particularly Security Council here, is taking North Korea at its word. Mm. And obviously it has the intention to go forward and perhaps, do other tests. So I don't think it's going to be very relevant. And interestingly enough, you would think if it were, China would be harping on that, and it has not.
It has not. Linda Fasulo at the UN. Linda, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, as this week ends, we want to spend some time today looking at the first big story of the 2008 Democratic presidential race. Yes, we said the 2008 presidential race. Some say one of the starting blocks is tonight with a sold-out dinner for Democrats in New Hampshire. And right at the starting gate, a dropout. Mark Warner announced yesterday he will not seek the Democratic presidential nomination, citing the impact a presidential bid would have on his family. So what's the impact of the pullout, and what's going on in the Democratic Party, which has seemed so sidelined? Joining us is Steve Jarding, who teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also co-author of Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland, and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Welcome back, Steve.
It's good to be on. Thank you, Rob.
Steve, speaking to us from Virginia. And up in New Hampshire, we're joined by Guy McMillan, editorial page editor at the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire. Welcome, as always, Guy.
Thank you, Robin.
And I want to start with you, Steve. You ran Mark Warner's successful campaign for governor in Virginia in 2000. This was your guy. Everything you've always talked about the Democrats needing, right?
Well, he certainly brought a lot of those qualities to the table. I mean, this was an individual who he did govern in a red state, governed very successfully, left office with an 80% job approval rating. He was able to do good things for education. He was able to work within the Republican-controlled legislature. But he was basically, his politics were moderate. He was somebody that I think would have been a great messenger to move into the South and into rural areas where Democrats have struggled. But I also understand the decision. I mean, anytime a political figure comes and says, I want to put family first, we can get pretty cynical in this business, but at some level you say, no, that's the one thing. If it's family, go be with your family. And I certainly understand that. He's got teenage girls at home, and he's been gone most of the last 5 years, so he wanted to spend time, and I certainly respect that.
Well, he's got teenagers looking at colleges and an elderly parent. A lot of people can identify with that. He's in the sandwich generation, but some people are saying that the decision was more because of his lack of foreign policy experience and the national security experience that the Republicans are hammering on. That's their message, and he wouldn't have that. So he might sit out this round. Your thoughts?
I don't think that's something that would have scared him out of the race. It certainly would have been an issue that would have come up in the race, and people would have said, well, can you show us that indeed that you have experience or at least the knowledge in this area that you can talk about. So, but I don't think that was the case. This is not somebody who, anybody ever accused of not being a student of public policy in a strange sort of way, not unlike a Bill Clinton.
Right.
You always heard stories about him. Well, Warner was the same way.
So, Steve Jarding, what's your over-under? I mean, is this a big deal to the Democrats?
Well, I think it's a big deal in this sense. The upside to Mark Warner was very large. I mean, this was an individual who a lot of people around the country looked at and said, if you look historically, it seems like we need a Southern governor, and this was someone who won when he wasn't supposed to, and he governed well. And the kind of the on the political side, this was also a very tenacious fundraiser. He'd raised almost $10 million into his PAC already this year. He's also personally wealthy, had the capacity to write a very big check. You put all of that together, and I think it leaves, if this race, Robin, is Hillary and everybody else, Warner was, at least for a lot of people, the obvious anti-Hillary candidate. If he's gone, that void, I think, is opened up.
Let's get Guy McMillan in on this, up in New Hampshire there. Guy, how is Warner's dropping out resonating there?
Well, it's not resonating at all among the average voters who barely got to know him. He was making a good impression up here. He'd been stumping for local candidates, and I think doing well enough in what you might call the third tier, because we are, after all, 15 months away from any election, and most people haven't heard of Mark Warner or some of his other third-tier friends like Evan Bayh and Bill Richardson, Tom Vilsack. These people have yet to really make a big splash, but they're dealing mostly with activists now, the party faithful,
right,
and they're up looking for support.
Well, and who's been up? Who's come up to New Hampshire?
Everybody's been here, except I don't believe Hillary Clinton has been here. She's sort of keeping her powder dry. But Edwards has been here a lot. Kerry has been here a lot.
That's Senator John Edwards, of course, Senator John Kerry, who's the keynote speaker tonight at this Jefferson Jackson dinner being held in Manchester. Some say this is the launching pad for the Democratic candidates. Possible past speakers have been launched there. Tell us more about the dinner.
I don't think it's as big a deal as the people that put it on think it is. Its slogan, by the way, this year is Keep New Hampshire Blue, which gives you an indication that it's pretty partisan.
How do people in New Hampshire feel about the dinner? Do they notice this? Or
doubt it. You know, there are other dinners going on here. Joe Biden's going to be in Keene tomorrow for a spaghetti dinner at the high school. People around Keene are more interested in that, I would think. And Bill Frist, we haven't talked about Republicans much yet today, but he's going to be up eating spaghetti next week in Concord. So a lot of spaghetti around. Giuliani, Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, he's been visiting New Hampshire the last couple of days. They're all over the place, and so one dinner is not going to make that much of a difference.
Right. We understand, speaking of former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, he's really taking that message that we were talking about, that the Republicans have been successfully in some places hammering home about security and war. What is he saying?
Well, that's what he's saying, security and war, kind of over and over. That's his message because, as you know, or as most political observers know, when you get kind of off that path with Giuliani, you get into very dangerous territory for Republicans. He's sort of a moderate in social issues, and he has a personal life that doesn't really stand up to a lot of scrutiny among the conservative wing of his party. So he talks about security, and he talks about war.
Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel up there in Keene, New Hampshire. I know you were struck by one particular visit this week. Tell us about that.
Well, Christopher Dodd, senator from Connecticut, who was also a candidate for president, almost admittedly, was here in Keene at the Keene State College Holocaust Center, which was celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials this week. And Dodd participated in a panel discussion on that and made some appearances around town. And his father was a prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, which I'd forgotten. And so the thing about that that kind of impressed me was that Dodd actually had a reason to be in New Hampshire this weekend, other than spaghetti or whatever. And he made a very good impression around here.
As we said, there have been so many other candidates and several apologies. We just want to ask you about that before we let you go to your good work. What were some of the candidates saying there?
Well, there are three apologies that impressed me. Kerry and Edwards have both apologized for their 2002 vote authorizing the war in Iraq. And they refused to do that in 2004 when they were running for president and president and vice president. Now they've said they're sorry, they wish they hadn't done it. Biden has apologized, finally, for plagiarizing a speech in 1988 that was given by the then head of the British Labour Party, a guy named Neil Kinnock. And Biden had been talking about his wife and his college education. It's a very personal speech. Turned out it was Kinnock's speech. And when Biden got called on it, he said, well, I usually credit Kinnock with this, but I just forgot to at one point. And he looked even more embarrassed at that point and dropped out of the race, if you remember.
Right.
He's now said he wishes he hadn't done it, and he won't do it again.
All right, so it was a week of mea culpas. Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel, Keene, New Hampshire. Enjoy that spaghetti, okay, Guy?
Oh, thanks a lot. Yep.
And Steve Darting, a Democratic consultant. Stay right there, because after we take a break, we're going to come right back. And we'll hear more about your thoughts on the Democratic presidential field for 2008, now that Mark Warner is out of the race. Names like Evan Bayh, Wesley Clark, Dom Vilsack are suddenly floating to the surface. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Of Mark Warner's announcement that he will not run for president in 2008. And as the Democrats have seemed to be sidelined lately, Republicans, you know, the party in power commanding most of the headlines of late. Steve Jarding was Mark Warner's gubernatorial campaign manager. He's author now of the book of advice for the Democrats called Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. So, Steve, what happens now? Mark Warner drops out, taking the hope of people in your wing of the party that the Democrats would have a moderate from the South. As things shake up, who are you looking at?
Well, I think this thing is wide open. With the one caveat that Hillary was always going to be the big dog in this fight. She just is. She's got the capacity to raise the money. She's got the name. She's got a husband that is kind of a rock star for a lot of Democrats, and so she has very tangible pluses. But what I think happens here is that with Warner, if Warner indeed was the leading anti-Hillary candidate, the alternative to Hillary, I think the field opens up rather dramatically. I mean, you could see now Whether Wes Clark gets in, I think his stock goes up with this. I think Evan Bayh's stock potentially goes up. I think John Edwards' stock potentially goes up because he's now, there's one less Southern guy in the race. But I also think you might kick a door open. Maybe you see a Barack Obama now saying, you know what, if Warner was kind of a logical anti-Hillary candidate and he had the capacity to raise or all this money or write a check, that obstacle's gone. Maybe I get in now. I mean, I really think that in many ways that while Hillary has certainly helped, a lot of these other candidates are helped as well and may well jump in this thing.
Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa's name's been mentioned?
Vilsack's problem to me, though, is he's got to win Iowa. I mean, it's, you know, you're going to get 125,000, 130,000 Iowans go vote. They're the hardest core Democrats. And in the Des Moines Register poll of a couple months ago, Vilsack barely hit double digits. His problem's going to be winning his own state, and that's going to be very difficult because I think you've got Hillary is going to have a big base there. John Edwards has a base there, making it almost impossible for Vilsack to get 50%. If he can't do at least that, I think he's done.
But the appeal of both Bayh and Vilsack is that they have both served as moderate governors of states that supported President Bush. You mentioned Barack Obama. Talk more about that, because he's very charismatic, of course, made the incredible breakthrough introductory speech at the Democratic Convention, but is he considered perhaps a little young?
Well, I think that's something he's going to have to deal with, not unlike some of these candidates who would have to deal with, do I have the experience? Obama would also face that. But the party's out looking for someone who they think can win. They're looking for someone who can excite the base. They're looking for someone who can rally Democrats together, who can unite them, who can perhaps take the country in a different direction with some bold leadership. And I think that means this thing is wide open. And while Obama would have to deal with the fact that he's younger, deal with the fact that he doesn't maybe have the experience that some might like, again, I think you have to step up and you watch how these guys play. And if they can overcome concerns that people have, not unlike George W. Bush did when people questioned that he didn't have enough foreign policy experience, they can actually go on and win a nomination and ultimately become president. So I just think this thing is absolutely wide open, and we're going to see a free-for-all as we head toward 2008.
Steve Jarding, author of Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Steve's a longtime political consultant. He's speaking to us from Virginia, and he has said and says in Foxes in the Hen House that the Democrats have to do something to appeal to the America that they've sort of abandoned. And let's just talk briefly about some of the things that you recommended the Democrats do last time we spoke. Number one, guns. This is a big issue with you. You say that Democrats have missed an opportunity to appeal to gun owners on the ground that they share, which is concern about the environment.
Yeah, no, there's no question. There's a lot of issues, and we certainly talk about them in the book, but guns is one of them, where if you look at, ask most hunters or most anglers, fishermen out there what the greatest problems are, it's not going to be that someone's taking their gun. It's that the environment is very polluted. Most of our streams anymore are in danger. Fish are either dying off or somehow, being affected by the pollution. And if you do surveys, and there's been a fair amount of research on this, most hunters will tell you their conservation is first, and those are Democratic issues. So, it's not just guns. I mean, in a lot of areas, if Democrats, I think, change the tenor of the debate and quit letting Republicans define the terms, whether it's guns or family values or fiscal conservatism, I believe Democrats can win on all those issues.
Well, Steve, let me ask you something. People might say, why are you talking so much about the Democrats today? Well, we have not talked a lot about the Democrats because they're not the party in power. The Republicans control every arm of government right now, so just about every issue filters through them. The sense is the Democrats don't have a message and don't have a voice.
Well, it's a problem, and I've been critical of Senator Kerry, who announced at Dartmouth College in February of 2004 that he wasn't going to go south. He said, why would a Democrat go south? Well, Senator, there's 102 million people that live in the South, and they need representation. And if you're not there giving a message, they're probably going to vote Republican. So I really think the process is very, very important always, but it's particularly important this time because both parties, I think, have a bit of a void. Both parties are uncertain as to what direction they should go in light of the economy that's shaky, in light of a war that's going poorly. And this time we're going to look at both parties. I think it's the first time since 1928 that we haven't had a sitting president or vice president running. So both of these are pretty wide open. And I think the nation's going to look at this election, and we're going to look real hard at who the real leaders are and what they're campaigning on.
Steve Jarding from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author with Dave Mudcat Saunders of the book Foxes in the Hen House, How the Republicans Stole the South and the Heartland, and What the Democrats Must Do to Run Them Out. Steve, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin. I appreciate it.
And we've got these two footnotes from the world of politics. Representative Bob Ney, Republican from Ohio, has pled guilty to conspiracy and making false statements. In federal court today in Washington, Ney admitted that he had taken money, gifts, and favors in return for official actions on behalf of Republican super lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his clients. Ney confessed to his crimes in a courthouse just blocks from the Capitol. He faces up to 10 years in prison. And Air America Radio, which was promoted as the antidote to the Fox News cable network, has filed for bankruptcy protection. The network, which features Al Franken and Jerry Springer, will stay on the air while it resolves issues with some of its creditors. And we have one program note for you. Next week, exporting patients. Our company's going to try to force employees to go abroad, say to India, for cheaper surgery. One company in North Carolina has already tried. We'll tell you that story. That's next week. But stay with us now. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the
Pesci economist is the winner, along with his bank Grameen, of this year's Nobel Peace Prize for the use of microcredit to transform the lives of millions of poor people. NYU economist Jonathan Murdoch says Yunus became one of the people responsible for a fundamental shift in thinking at institutions like the World Bank, showing that poor people matter and can be good customers, too. Here is Yunus on NPR's The Connection in 2000, describing how he began his work.
We began in one village back in 1976, giving 42 people a total of $27. That was our starting point. And it worked. People paid back. Not a single penny was missed.
Harvard philosopher and economist Amartya Sen is also a Nobel Prize winner for economics in 1998 and a friend of Muhammad Yunus, and he joins us now. Welcome, Professor Sen.
Oh, thank you.
And how does microcredit work?
Well, it works by a very basic economic principle on which all of economic relations rely, namely trust. You know, very often people think that that economics proceeds only on the basis of a kind of hard guarantee, a police force behind. Hmm. But much of the actions take place on the basis of trust.
It's sort of an honor system.
It's an honor system. But you see, there has always been a kind of big dividing line saying that people who don't have any money, any capital, they're not very trustworthy. That's the original view, because you know, if something falls, something goes wrong, they could not. There's nothing for them to fall back on to return their money. Now, I think what Yunus's idea here was to say that that's not the right way of thinking about it, because these people would, if you trust them, and trust them to give money even without what is called a security or a collateral, they would appreciate it and work very hard. But, you know, to that, Robin, I have to add the fact that Yunus had other visionary things. I've known him because he's a very old friend, mm-hmm. and I've known him for over 30 years now. So he had this notion that the neglected parts of the Bangladeshi society were the fact that, unlike in many parts of the world, women had a very positive role in Bengali rural culture. And they could be given an economic and social role that they already had culturally, but which could be extended. So quite often the people to whom Yunus's microcredit system lent money were the woman of the family, rather than a man of the family.
We understand, in fact, that he stumbled across a woman who was doing some work, and she was working with bamboo, and she'd been given, I think, 9 cents by a lender.
Robin, I'm not surprised that people would concentrate on these, you know, great stories.
It's a great story.
Yeah, these are all great stories, but I think there's a bigger picture, really, Robin. I mean, these stories are fantastic, but they are illustrating a very big point, namely, economic trust can be placed on people who are very poor, and they will, if you trust them, work with you to make a success of a movement that can bring about social change in a radical way. And in fact, getting participation for women in a society is extremely important. And of course, people in these days, thanks to all these peculiar things we have about clash of civilization. Bangladesh will be defined simply as a Muslim civilization. But the fact is that it has a enormously important message for the global culture, which is not connected with religion at all. It's connected with a social vision.
Well, and just to complete that story, Eunice gave that woman some money to buy her own bamboo so she wouldn't be an indentured servant, and she was so grateful that, of course, as you said, she paid her back. But we understand that there was another underpinning to this thinking, that loans were then given, when it got more sophisticated, to groups of five people, so that how did it work? Two people would get the loan at the time, so that
Well, the way it works is to bring in a sense of collective responsibility about
right.
it, in the sense that, you know, for one thing, of course, you have several people. There's no question of one person suddenly absconding and going away, because you can't, you know,
right.
decamp with five or six people. But I think the most important thing is the philosophy underlying it. If the microcredit movement movement is based on a principle of collaboration, one form of collaboration is collaboration by borrowers. And that, of course, allows them to plan an economic change. So in some ways, there's a kind of inspiration. And the thing to recognize here is that Yunus is both a person of vision as well as a person who inspires confidence in him. When I first met him, this was, you know, he was one of those who was involved in the independent movement in Bangladesh in 1971. You know, courageous man, and went back and took completely non-sectarian view of the world. And he's a very, very talented person. The whole family is talented, something which people are not singing so much about. But let me say, his daughter, Monica, is a very beautiful opera singer. And, you know, it's a very talented family.
Well, for those who might ask, why is a man who works in economics winning the Peace Prize? It is about more than money for him. Here he is describing what his program does for the poor.
I have been arguing that creativity-wise, there is no difference between richest man in the world and the poorest person in the world. So only difference is the other guy got the opportunity to bring it out, and the person at the bottom never got the opportunity to bring it out. That's the difference. So this money becomes the key to open himself or herself up. So unlike a job where you do the work and go home, you never know what you are, because you never got a chance to explore yourself. So this gives the opportunity. And gradually, they find out that they know more things, they have more abilities than anybody ever told them. And that leads to the next step, to explore further. So the Grameen is not only about lending money, it's not about money, it's about people. It's exploring the self-worth of a person and establishing the dignity of the person.
I want to ask you, Professor, I bet there's a lot of excitement about this in Bangladesh. You were saying to us earlier this morning in Calcutta. What's been the reaction to this?
Well, I think the people are very happy on both sides of the border, both in Bangladesh and in India and West Bengal. He's a hero, of course, and deservedly so. Indeed, he has a lot of friends across the world, and nearly 60 countries now have microcredit movement.
There are a lot of, well, I was going to say, it is a wonderful idea. Some would say that's a nice idea, but as an economist, does it work?
Well, I think the proof of the pudding is in eating. We have had a fair amount of eating here. So, no, I think there's every evidence that it works very well. I think that the thing to ask, of course, is a more difficult question, that when led directly by as inspirational, visionary a person and as good a leader as Yunus, what succeeds? Will it succeed even without having the magical presence of a magnetic personality like Yunus? I think that's where the real challenge is, and my belief is that the idea is a very general one, and obviously is helped by having somebody as captivating as Yunus is. But once the idea is on the roll and people recognize it works, and if it's well organized, organization is extraordinarily important in this, then the microcredit movement could bring about a real change across the world.
Harvard philosopher, economist, Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen speaking about Muhammad Yunus, the Stanford-trained Bangladeshi economist who, it was announced today, won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for his pioneering use of microcredit. Professor Sen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Joan Rivers couldn't have done better. At times, it did seem more like a scene from the Oscar pre-show, as President Bush shifted away from questions about North Korea's nuclear testing and the death toll in Iraq at this week's Rose Garden press conference to comment on reporters' wardrobes. First up, ABC's Kevin Cork, sporting a smart pinstripe suit, red tie, and pocket square.
Thank you, Mr. President.
If I might say, that is a beautiful suit.
Thank you, sir. My tailor.
And I can't see anybody else who even comes close.
Thank you very much. I'll be happy to pass along my tailor's number if you'd like that, sir.
But then the president noticed CNN's Suzanne Malveaux sporting a stunning Benetton suit with pink pinstripes, and he flip-flopped.
Suzanne, first best dressed person here, sorry.
Kevin and I coordinated.
Yeah. No, it actually looks... Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Poor Jim Axelrod of CBS. His somewhat rumpled sports coat brought a presidential rebuke.
My best suit's in the cleaners.
It's not even a suit.
I know. You got to give me more time in the morning with the news conference.
Yeah, I know. You like to wake up about 8:30.
I want to ask
you... High-priced news guys.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, the well-dressed Kevin Cork did offer his tailor's phone number, and we decided to take him up on that. On the line is Kurt Sace of the Tom James Company. Kurt, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you custom make that suit, or did you just alter one off the rack? I mean, describe Kevin Cork's suit.
Kevin's suit is custom made, the classic navy chalk stripe, beautiful fabric.
Yes, it was. And the Washington Post wrote that it cost $1,500. What's the price range for the custom suits? And who else do you dress in Washington?
We dress a lot of people in Washington, senior partners, most of the big firms around town, some senators, some congressmen, some government officials.
What would you say about the Washington Press Corps in general? Have they all spiffed up a bit? Because, you know, they used to be the image of the ink-stained wretch, you know, and they do seem to be kind of fashion-forward now.
You know, it's nothing like high-definition TV to make people dress up a little bit, you know? I believe, you know, quite candidly, that the technology is pushing things. People see it more clearly. They can't, you know, walk into the studio anymore with a rumpled blazer on.
Or the president will yell at them.
That's exactly right. Well, he should.
Well, what about presidents and lawmakers? I mean, is there a difference between the way Democrats and Republicans dress, for instance, when it comes to suits?
No, not that I can see. I mean, what I find is that they tend to try to mirror whatever their constituency is. You know, if they're from the Midwest, they tend to be more conservative. If they're from the East Coast or the West Coast, they might be a little bit more pizzazz to their clothing, so to speak. But they do tend to generally wear, you know, a lot of similar things that look good on TV.
No offense. I mean, here it is, your job at the Tom James Company to make suits. Some of us see them as, well, suits. You know, they're sort of a blur.
Right.
What stands out for you? Like, what should we look for? What makes a great suit?
First off, you know, what is the fabric? Does it have any character to it? Does it have any personality, so to speak? I mean, you can take just a plain navy suit, and if it's a beautiful fabric, you can really see it up, you know, when you're actually in the presence of it. Next thing is, you know, how does it actually fit? Clothing should be made to fit you.
Right. And how about the president? We know his suits are made by Georges de Paris, or maybe it's George of Paris. The tailor to presidents since Lyndon Johnson's time. Do you have any advice for him in his clothes, or has he got it quite right?
President looks good in his clothing. I mean, he buys, I think, from a variety of places, and he tends to wear blues 90% of the time that I remember, and certainly that classic, almost like, quote, President Bush blue tie. You know, communicates confidence. He looks poised behind the podium. I mean, you know, generally speaking, when you see him moving around, his clothing fits well.
The tie, that's interesting, isn't it, that he wears a blue tie?
Yeah, he really is someone who, you know, a lot of people always were wearing reds or red stripes or something like that, but he is really loves that look and that sort of neon blue, and I think it's almost become sort of a signature for him. There's a lot of people that would say that blue kind of communicates truth, confidence, believability. Certainly, when you're up in front of the press corps, you want that.
Kurt Sace, tailor to some of Washington's best dressed. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And this fashion update, we note that at today's signing ceremony for the Port Security Act, the president was actually sporting a red tie. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. your thoughts. This week, the British journal The Lancet released a study claiming 655,000 Iraqis have died in the war there. Borzu Dargahi, Los Angeles Times Baghdad bureau chief, told us he thought that number sounded way too high. Well, that prompted Susan Dews from Morristown, New Jersey, to write, "In World War II, many people in Germany had no idea of the magnitude of the Holocaust. So The Lancet study should be seriously considered, even if only half the number of people died that was estimated in the study. That still means over a quarter of a million people have been killed." Well, we also had a lot of response this week after our segment on the debate over single-sex education. Adam Eggleston of Tucson, Arizona, a public school teacher, writes, "The only time I can see separating boys and girls being beneficial is between the sixth and eighth grades. It's during this time, with puberty in full swing, that the distraction between the sexes, as well as competition within each sex, seems to be most detrimental. What about a temporary separation of the sexes?" Well, Jeanette Pinckney of Charlotte, North Carolina, went to a single-sex high school.
I believe that a very important side benefit was that I learned to be a leader without comparison to boys and was not distracted as much by the other sex as I would have been had I been attending a dual-sex high school. Not to mention that I also can now lead in a very popular dance called the bop. Have a good time when you dance a little bit to the bop, to the bop. Dance a little bit to the bop. We'll dance a little bit to the bop. We'll dance to the rock and roll. Yeah, and I dance, 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 yeah. Dance, 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 yeah.
So there. And to remind you, the bop was first a dance craze in the 50s, was revived in the 70s. Singer Gene Vincent had a hit single back in 1957 called Dance to the Bop. Finally, following our visit to the What the Fluff Festival in Somerville, Massachusetts, where tributes to marshmallow fluff abounded, Allegra from Brattleboro, Vermont, was one of many who asked for the recipe for erupting fluff volcano cake. We've posted it on our website. We have one requirement. You send us some.
Oh, you need fluff, fluff, fluff to make a fluffer dutter. Marshmallow fluff and lots of peanut butter.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org, or give us a call. You can leave a message at 617-358-0397. The sound of a kitten walking along the keyboard of an electric piano. You can watch and listen to Kitten Composer on YouTube.com. The video sharing site just got gobbled up by Google this week for more than $1.5 billion because YouTube gets about 100 million hits a day. Advertisers and TV networks are also hoping to capitalize on the internet video boom. But some industry watchers say the new medium is more about creativity and community than cash. Here Now's Andrea Shea spoke to some Boston-area video artists, also known as vloggers or vloggers, about this online phenomenon. YouTube might be the reigning site for online video this week, but it isn't the only act in town. You can find short amateur spoofs, newscasts, stunts, confessions, and quirky autobiographical videos all over the internet. It's Jerry Time is one of them. It's Jerry Time debuted last November as a video blog or vlog, which means the show is self-distributed via its own website. Two brothers, Jerry and Oren Zucker, work on the animated series in Needham, where Oren lives.
We're going down to the basement here where we do all the magic. It's pretty cramped here. It's usually a lot messier. We cleaned it up because we knew you were coming.
The main character in It's Jerry Time is based on the real-life exploits of Jerry Zucker. He's lived all over the country and has had lots of jobs, acting, truck driving, cartooning. In reviews, the character Jerry has been compared with Jerry Seinfeld and Charlie Brown.
I've always had this thing about telling stories.
In the past, Jerry told those stories only to his brother. Now, It's Jerry Time is the result of what he calls the beaker theory.
You could only fill up a beaker only so much until it starts to pour out the top. So I guess there was this one time where I was telling him the Who's That Guy story. That's our first episode. on the way back from Wendy's. And he goes, okay, something snapped. That's it. Let's try to animate this and see what happens.
I went over to the popcorn machine automatically, and I just started filling up the basket. And I looked around, and the bartender, who was a woman, was talking to the manager, and she pointed to me, and she goes, "Who's that guy?"
What you see here is a detailed, moving photo montage of Jerry. He's pieced together, but his parts don't fit quite right. His huge head sits on his tiny body. The effect is kind of grotesque, according to Oren Zucker, especially the bug eyes.
The first time I ever saw Jerry blinking back at me, I was really freaked out.
But the online video watching community was thrilled. After posting that first episode on their website, the brothers tracked a flurry of hits. It's Jerry Time has won a bunch of awards at film festivals and the like, and was even nominated for the first ever online video Emmy. Oren Zucker says television executives have expressed interest in their online videos.
I think the potential is there to have some sort of a show from this. You know, we do have a rep in Hollywood, and he's been talking to some people.
But nothing's transpired so far because of the many unanswered questions surrounding what's been called the user-generated online video boom. Heather Green is the Internet Department Editor for Business Week magazine.
The biggest question really has to be, if you're a company, is there a way, or if you're a startup who wants to make money, is there a way to make money on this, or is this really just about communications? And it's hard to really figure out where you can create a business model around it.
Green says the money will come as more advertisers step up to the plate, but the paradigm is still unproven. The Google-YouTube buyout might change things, says Green, but people are still wary after the internet bust in the late 1990s. She adds, though, that they're also tantalized by the whole idea of the social media movement. Regardless, vloggers continue to hurl themselves headlong into the internet video revolution, hoping to find community while turning what for many is a hobby into a livelihood.
No, I'm not making a living.
Steve Garfield is an obsessive vlogger. He works out of his home in Jamaica Plain. Upstairs, Garfield queues up one of his many video blogs.
I have this show called The Carol and Steve Show, and last year I did 53 episodes of it, and it was just what my wife and I did over the weekend.
It sounds deadly, but Garfield turns his average video footage into a sitcom with its own theme song, credits, and music. Garfield has managed to cobble together a day job out of his vlogging habit. He does a fair bit of consulting and beta testing and actually helped the Zucker brothers get It's Jerry Time up and running. But still, it's a struggle. Like the Zuckers, Garfield says he's received calls from TV executives trying to get in on the action.
So the problem for someone like me trying to figure all this out is that media comes in and they have a site and they're like, hey, come on, send us your content. And in a way, they want our content for free so they can make money off it. And we would probably like to make a little money.
Steve Garfield says he experiments with posting some of his videos on YouTube, but he prefers to use other sites, such as Blip TV, that share revenue with vloggers and are more in touch with the video blogging community.
Our visit with the vloggers, the vloggers, was produced by Andrea Shea. To find out more about the sites she mentioned, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.